I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and comedian and podcaster Graham Clark. The disaster movie has, most unfortunately, gone out of style in the wake of apocalyptic events being prevented and perpetrated by superheroes. However, it is one when it rears its multifaceted head, gives you a serious bang for your buck. The 70s were rife with fantastic disaster movies like The Towering Inferno, Earthquake, and one of my personal new favorites, The Poseidon Adventure, which I think I have mentioned at least four times this season so far. And then a little movie called Airplane took all the fun out of the genre by adding a bunch of, well, fun. The 80s released a few solid nuclear fear-based movies like The Day After, we discussed in our first season, but don't worry, the advent of CGI and the lack of any discernible American international enemy in a pre-9/11 world left plenty of room for twisters, Titanics, and turbulence to wow us all. Let's talk the 90s disaster movie boom, which is like really 3 years, like 96 to like 99. Cam, what do you think?
I mean, I think it depends on if you count something like Jurassic Park as a disaster movie, which I would. I feel like that kind of helped. But yeah, I know what you mean. Part of the reason we are looking at these ones is we briefly considered 1997 as also the year of Dante's Peak / Volcano.
I remember it well, yeah.
Yes. So it's like, yeah, this was just a genre. Which is still kind of, you know, Roland Emmerich comes now and again to put Gerard Butler in danger usually these days. But yeah, you're right. It's something where like, it's just like the perfect moment where practical effects and CGI. And I think when I was trying to think like, why was this the 90s? And also, is this, we're all more or less the same age cohort. So is this just rocking chair nostalgia where we're like, ah, yeah, it's the best time? But no, I think it's like a thing where there was always something new that you had not seen yet on screen, and so it felt like every time these movies were showing something somewhat realistically. Right.
I remember Independence Day, the trailer in the theater knocked everybody's socks off because mm-hmm. You were seeing these iconic landmarks blowing up, and it's just like, oh, this is going to be the greatest movie. And
it was,
you know what?
We're going to get to Bill Clinton's love of these movies. And apparently he still, to this day, quotes Independence Day. Independence Day is his favorite. He still wishes that aliens had come into fruition while he was president.
Like, he would have been a good president for that. He's a good speaker.
Yeah? He wouldn't try to have sex with the aliens?
Well, I mean, that's his own business.
Okay, fair enough. What goes on behind closed doors.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I don't, it's a very interesting situation because and it was the movies that excited me. It's not a family movie because these movies are pretty violent, but mm-hmm. these movies are also rated like PG. Like, as violent as they are, I think this was kind of a thing that you would bring an older kid to and grandma.
Yeah, like Twister was a family film, right?
Yeah. Twister for sure. And I remember Twister being also like, that blew my mind. Like seeing them make a tornado it sounds so old timey, but it's like, that was crazy in 1996 or whatever.
It's like you say, it was like some mix of, if they knew what they were doing, it's a mix of good practical effects and then CG. But some of the movies didn't have access to good CG. And I think one of them you'll hear about today.
And I mean, I think some of them leaned either way and it was a choice. And maybe they made the right choice. Also, sometimes I think they blew a ton of money, as we will also talk about, not using CGI, and maybe they regret that.
Well, right. This is something I think is really interesting that I kind of want to bring up here, is that we
didn't have any international enemies really in the late 90s before 9/11, right? In 9/11, neither of these movies would have gotten made, like any time after that, for at least a decade.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of interesting to see, okay, who are our villains and who can we fight against, right? So like in Independence Day, there's like this huge speech which rallies the world, perpetrated by the Americans, you know, against the aliens. Yeah. And then here you've got actual peace with the Russians, that they were working, that the Americans were working with the Russians for this cohort one in Air Force One, and it's extremists, it's Russian extremists, right? So it's people on the fringes.
Right.
And I think that's really interesting that we didn't have enemies. And that's one of the reasons why, like, the X-Files was so big, because it was, like, within the government conspiracy stuff. Like, we had no externals, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah, and I mean, this is also interesting because this year is, well, another thing we considered along with the volcano in Dante's Peak is this is a weird year because it's right before the Bill Clinton scandals kind of coalesce. Mm. They were always around, but everybody kind of liked the president and it seemed chill. So there was movies like this one and like Absolute Power where like the president's evil. And yeah, so there's kind of this idea that, yeah, things are chill. But at the same time, I think they loved a kind of like a Bosnia adjacent bad guy in like James Bond and stuff. That essentially that there was these Soviet people out there, and they loved a serial killer weirdo like Ray Liotta will be in our second movie too.
I think that's every generation loves a serial killer.
Yes,
it's like you can stick that in any generation, everybody loves it,
and the more caricature-y, the better. All right, let's get into Air Force One, because I know we're all itching to do it. So of all the enemies the U.S. has loved to battle, it's the Russians. But in 1997, things were pretty quiet in the Soviet Union. So how did Hollywood create an enemy to hijack a plane occupied by the president and his staff? With the president, played by all-American curmudgeon Harrison Ford, going head-to-head against chameleon-accented Gary Oldman. In fact, Ford still says his favorite enemy he's gone up against is Oldman's Korshnov. Graham, you have a special relationship to Air Force One, so do you want to just walk us through the plot a little bit before we get into this?
Sure. The plot, as it were, the president and co. are all on Air Force One. They have just put a big enemy of both America and Russia in prison, and he is flying back to America and boarding the plane as some press folk who turn out to be terrorists from a fringe group that wants to unite Mother Russia or something like that. And they take over the plane, and they think that the president has escaped through an emergency pod, but he actually is on the plane and becomes kind of a thorn in the terrorist side. And he slowly wrangles back power of Air Force One and defeats the bad guys, which is no surprise. And it's also I did not remember this, but it was the mumbliest movie I've seen in a long time. Yeah. I missed so much dialogue. and it's a dad movie. It's dad movie supreme. I know my dad's enjoyed it. And I do too. There's a certain age you pass, and then all of a sudden you want to hear like an old guy taking over.
He literally says,
"Get off my plane.
Get off my plane."
Yes.
I am fascinated by this movie, and I was telling Graham earlier that when I started to watch it, I was like, this is absurd. Oh no, it gets more absurd. Oh no, it gets weirder. And it's interesting to me that when it was created with this air and intention of being as authentic as possible if a situation was going to happen. But watching it now, you're like, no, that can't happen. That can't happen.
At the same time, another movie that I know is kind of similar was the Olympus Has Fallen movies were all about, like, we talked with the White House about what the procedure is when DC is attacked. And that one's way more preposterous, whereas this one at least seems a little like we're hearing a lot about procedures. I mean, we learn about the Constitution. It's like,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. There's a whole thread of like, what does the Constitution say about whether the president is the president or is not the president?
So apparently that's based on an actual event. When Reagan was shot, which people might not remember, Reagan was shot by John Hinckley Jr., who was trying to win the love of Jodie Foster. That's a story I'm sure we'll get into eventually. There was an attempt by Alexander Haig to take over the government because he believed wrongly that the Secretary of State was the person who was in charge if something happened to the president. Mm. Apparently, Haig had been jockeying for more power, so this was actually considered a coup attempt, and he was later ousted in part because he tried to grab power while Reagan was out of commission.
Wow.
So that was a real thing. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a great, yeah. It's a strange movie because you're right. And Wolfgang Petersen is kind of a classy director who becomes this disaster movie guy after this, pretty much. But before,
what else did he do after it? Poseidon
is kind of his big lampooned one because he tried to remake it. But I think, from that point of view. But I guess, so he did Outbreak, which I guess is a bit of a disaster movie.
Oh, yeah, that's still a disaster movie.
Fire.
Yeah.
And then The Perfect Storm, which is kind of the classiest disaster.
Oh, George Clooney and company.
I believe mm-hmm. that you're forgetting his before stuff, like Das Boot and, of course, The yes. Never-Ending Story, which this man has a very eclectic resume.
Yes. Well, I mean, he's a very fascinating guy because he's essentially Jürgen Prochnow now, who's barely in this movie, who is the general who's in jail, who weirdly at the time was a fairly recognizable American actor. They were kind of a team, and Jürgen Prochnow now is like the hottest thing in Germany. And they have like a very groundbreaking gay film, which is kind of fascinating from Germany, which you wouldn't think, but then they did Das Boot, and that just like rocketed both of them to huge international fame. And yeah, I have no idea why Never Ending Story was his first choice of an American movie, but it's a good movie.
It is a good movie.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Maybe just like movies about things that could fly. Maybe that was deep-seated in his psyche.
And apparently he got deep into almost directing Harry Potter, and he at the end was like, nah, I don't want to do it. So he still had that magical
but
child.
But there weren't enough right hooks. I think that's the problem. Not enough right hooks,
sure.
You know. It's, but they're still dealing with takeover. Like, he's really good at these, like, big, grand set pieces that are happening from within. Like, Das Boot is, like, so realistic and so gritty. I remember that was a movie I kept having to pause and then walk away and be like, I am not in a submarine. Everything is fine. I can come back.
Yeah, so claustrophobic. My goodness.
And that's kind of the same thing that he's done here, except for he's translated it to big budget. And a lot of independent filmmakers like that can't do that translation, and I think he does that really well. It's just like Das Boot but sped up.
Sure. And an interesting thing, I've never seen it, but he used the money from Air Force One because he had a crazy payday for this. I think you had a fact where it's like he made 40 times what the president makes or whatever. But
nice.
Yeah, exactly. He used it to essentially release a Quentin Tarantino style director's cut of Das Boot that's like 7 hours long and on TV, which now is considered sort of the definitive version of Das Boot. It's like a giant movie, but it's very weird. It's also trying to get in like the headspace of the 90s, because I watched a clip with Glenn Close and she was like, oh, I really wanted to work with Wolfgang Petersen, to which you're like, well, he's like the disaster movie guy, but she loved In the Line of Fire, that Clint Eastwood, the other dad movie that he did, so I guess it's like there's this 90s thing of adult thrillers that are taken sort of seriously and are like pseudo Oscar, because I mean Das Boot was up for like 8 Oscars too.
I read an article about like what happened to the adult movie, like a movie that was made for adults. Like it's kind of all centered around what young people want to watch this kind of like, because you're right, like In the Line of Fire, all those Clancy's and whatnot were meant, you know, meant with an older audience in mind, but I don't know if those exist anymore.
No,
like big budget.
We actually talked
movies.
About this when we talked about Michael Clayton, is that it's claimed that Michael Clayton was the last of the adult movies, and that was 2007.
Sure.
And I mean, going back and watching that one, man, that movie's great. But it's right. Like anytime after that, you don't have these like really intellectual thrillers where like things are sort of plotted out and it's about this like organization. You have to have, I mean, Air Force One kind of combines the best of both those worlds, because there's like enough explosions and people getting thrown out of planes and like, you know, bizarre plane crashes and bullets to keep like a certain demographic entertained, and then the other half is like, here's, you know, what happens when a president is incapacitated in 25th Amendment stuff, which we were not concerned about until recently. So
pretty much all the Glenn Close as vice president stuff is incredibly like dry and for adults. Like no kid is excited about like the procedural chain of command.
Yeah, chain of command, exactly.
Like, I also feel like in the future that his daughter would have been a bigger role, yeah. right? Like, even 5 years later, you would have had that girl, like, sneaking off and doing stuff, but she's really just a hostage in this.
It's, like, hard to picture. Like, I think I could picture Obama maybe taking on a terrorist or two. Like, can you imagine Donald Trump or Joe Biden sneaking around shooting people?
I mean, I can't imagine Bill Clinton either. I mean, that's the, yeah, they go out of their way to be like the usual, like, he was a decorated Vietnam veteran, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
To try to make, but I do like, I will say another thing I like, which I think has kind of gone the way of the dodo, is he is a pretty regular guy. Other than the ability to fly a plane and shoot a gun and like being a little crafty.
Yeah.
He kind of sucks. Like, he's not good at, he shoots the gun a lot, but he doesn't hit a lot of guys.
No, that's true. There's like there's a lot of bullets flying around flying vehicle.
Yes, that is true, too. I definitely expected, they don't really have the, like, classic part of the plane blows out, which is in our other movie, and they have to deal with that, because I guess Air Force One is meant to be bulletproof, and they're like, yeah. But anyway, right. I find that, and every fist fight he has, it looks like a kind of old guy having a fist fight and barely winning, which I kind of appreciate because nowadays it's all John Wicks and Takens where they all have like Krav Maga skills.
But it's also a really interesting contrast from how you see him cat and mouse with Gary Oldman. And people talk about this as being like one of Gary Oldman's greatest roles. They called him Scary Gary on set. Like he's you know, terrifying. But you don't really get to see them confront each other very often. And when they do, it's a psychological battle. It's not a physical battle, which is interesting to me as well.
I'm what you came for. Don't forget that. Then I killed them. Just one. You pick. That's what you do in the White House. You play God.
Well, I mean, except for that one scene where he kicks the crap out of him.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. He does get to kick the crap out of him in the end. But yeah, you're right. It's a lot of like, and it's a lot of Gary Oldman early on, essentially like calling your president a real cuck. He's like, this weakling escaped on a pod. And the weird thing is, like, you kind of wish there was no trailers for this movie because they don't show that the president's on the plane. They go about 20 minutes pretending that he's not on the plane. Yeah. It's a great reveal, yeah. But it's like too bad that, I mean, even the trailer, I seem to remember that he said, like, get off my plane. In it. Well, yeah, I don't know. Graham, what's your feelings on Harrison Ford as like an action guy? Do you like him?
I can see like exactly what you're saying is like he looks like a guy who is an average kind of guy. You know, he's got like an average kind of build and looks kind of like he's good looking, but he's not stunning. I mean, maybe some people would disagree with that, but he looks like a regular guy, and I think that they did a good job of making it like he's not a crack shot. He's not somebody who can knock people out with one punch. Like he's getting thrown around just as much as the bad guys seem to be. The only thing that's so hilarious is that he wears the suit from the beginning of the movie to the last frame of the movie. He's wearing the same suit, never takes the coat off, never undoes the tie.
Yeah. I didn't even think of that. You think, it might be, or just get torn.
Yeah,
like he's
exactly.
in a million crazy situations.
God. What do you want to bet for authenticity's sake? He insisted on wearing that suit the whole time and it stank to high heaven. just the one suit covered in blood. Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where they're all just covered in the corn syrup.
Yeah, like you're used to eventually them stripping down to a white layer so that you can see how much, you know, scuzz ends up on them. And it didn't happen in this movie.
No.
He's ready to go right back to the White House.
Yeah.
I think what was remarkable to me is how proud he was of this movie when it was coming out and how proud he still is of this movie. Like, this is like one of his gold standard films where he's like, I'm really proud of what it says about America and I'm really proud of like how much work we put into it. And like, it's his thread pulling, string pulling, not thread pulling, different pulling, that was able to get this as authentic as it was, because apparently they couldn't get access to the real Air Force One, which is obviously like, you know, a bunker. It's impossible to get to. So what he did was he went to some sort of event that Bill Clinton was at, who just happened to be hanging out with Glenn Close, because of course, and he was like, hey man, I'm just shooting a movie. Can me and my people just come hang out on Air Force One for the day? And Bill Clinton was like, sure, why not? Come hang out on Air Force One. So that's how they got on to be like, okay, this is what it looks like. But like, they were surrounded by like guys with guns the entire time. They're like, yeah, there's no way. And the other thing I love is that in this interview I watched with Charlie Rose, Harrison Ford talks a lot about how this is his ideal of what leadership should look like in the 90s. And he talks about the opening speech so much. And it's about like people really getting out of politics and doing what they think is right, getting out of this bipartisanship. And I'm like, that's really interesting. You're seeing that then, and that's the statement you're making.
Tonight I come to you with a pledge to change America's policy. Never again will I allow our political self-interest to deter us from doing what we know to be morally right.
And I also, like, I found Gary Oldman's character had a real, like, logic to him. He wasn't just like, we want to rule the world. It's like, you as a country have invaded all these countries and killed hundreds of thousands of people, and just because you want to save on gas.
Yeah.
And you're like, that sounds very realistic. Like, you're like, that's what grievance a terrorist might have with America, as opposed to like, we want $1 billion or we want you to like pull out of some area. Like, they want one guy released, which is logical and sane. And then his logic actually makes sense, kind of like Thanos or something, like where you're like, okay, I do understand this. There is a logic to there that I can see.
Yeah, and I like that he kind of gives speeches about, which now I think is the go-to of just about any bad guy on a movie, because I think they're all kind of like, you know, like 9/11 style terrorists now, that he says, like, you know, I believe something more than I care about my family. Like, you kind of can't stop me because my beliefs are so strong. Which is, I think you're right. And it is interesting where it's like, oh, he's kind of right. Some of this stuff is kind of right. And the fact that Harrison Ford kicks his ass and throws him off a plane probably is not going to like stop U.S. interventionalism in overseas.
Yeah. How did we feel about the fact that the worst death, like the most horrific death in this movie, is saved at the very end for the traitor?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, he is. That's right.
I mean, I think Gary Oldman's neck snap is maybe worse.
Okay, let's see. The plane gets hit and then it falls into the ocean and then it turns over repeatedly in the ocean as you're watching a little CGI version of him get tossed about. And then the plane explodes. Like, that's pretty intense.
I do think that Xander Berkeley, who plays this like turncoat Secret Service agent, is like, that's one of the coolest parts of the movie, because they reveal him to be bad right at the start. He's the first bad guy, you know, and then they don't let it, they have him sit there for like 2 hours, to the point where you're even like, maybe this guy just bailed on the terrorist idea and is literally helping out.
Like, it seemed logical to me that he was like, okay, I'm on the good guy side, because the bad guy side has been taken over, so I'm just gonna be back on good guy side. And he would have gotten away with it if he didn't freak out in the last, you know, scene.
2 seconds.
Poor William H. Macy. There was not a movie in the 90s he was getting out of unscathed. It's just not.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
I got to say, I was shocked. My memory of this movie was pretty bad, and I was shocked he got as far as he got, I'll be honest. I thought he was going to get got right away.
Yeah. And a real, like, a waste of William H. Macy.
Yeah. But this
like,
is Oscar-nominated. Yeah. Like, this is when he was still, hadn't even played the minor in Mystery Men yet, I don't think. Sure. So, you know, he still was kind of building his name. He was a big deal on Broadway, which is probably where they got them. I think this is an excellent use of Glenn Close. I'm actually really impressed at number one, how much they give her to do, and that she gets all these great scenes that you have to be a really compelling actor, because she doesn't do anything. She stands in a room and talks policy, right? But like, just watching her reaction shots when she's on the phone doing the negotiations and how powerless she actually is but doesn't want to give that impression, it's a really great line she plays where she never becomes too whiny, or like you never actually feel like she's powerless, like she's always on the up. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. It's a great performance.
If we're going to act, we have to act now.
It's too risky.
The president is up there with a gun to his head.
He's asking us to do that? To Air Force One?
He's not asking. Your commander-in-chief has issued a direct order. Do it!
I watched a nice little video of Glenn Close talking about it, because she was super late cast, because she points out that her wig is a wig from another movie, because she just had to throw on whatever wig was handy. But also, I think what you're talking about, where this movie seems to, like, I couldn't find much about it being a script that existed much before they started making it. I think they kind of made it as they went. And one thing she demanded was that her character was, it was always supposed to be a lady vice president. But when she came on, she said she wasn't going to cry. There was like a scene where she cried and she's like, the lady vice president would not cry in front of anyone. So yeah. It's cool. I don't know.
It's often too, like the people on the ground and like, air traffic control or whatever. Yeah. They all know what they're doing so well. Mm-hmm. And this was like, yeah, people are, they don't know what the rule is and they're going back and forth. And because that's probably more like what it would be like. It wouldn't be like stations, everybody, and just keep doing what you're doing. You know, it would be a lot of like, I'm the boss. No, why are you the boss? You know?
Yeah, if anything, we're really missing the air traffic control element that's usually in a plane thriller.
Don't worry,
there's no
we're gonna get plenty
sweating.
More of that in the next film we're talking about.
True,
because she's not a stewardess; she is a flight attendant.
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, it's a crazy movie, and I love. There's so many nice little turns. And I think that's a lot of like back and forth between everybody. Cause I mean, Wolfgang Petersen, I believe they shot a whole thing of Xander Berkeley explaining why he turned bad and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, it doesn't matter. And I mean, I love the fax machine lady that knows about the fax machine.
My favorite, kind of mirroring scene in the movie is when all the hostages are jumping out of the plane with parachutes. The fax lady. Mm-hmm. Flies very close to camera and she's having the time of her life. Yeah. She's so happy. And then you see that exact shot again and it's Gary Oldman with his neck snap.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we should get into the sort of wild CGI shots, but that one of her is a delight.
It's so funny.
There's something about the corniness of that like green screen makes hers hilarious and Oldman's hilarious, but in the right way, I think.
I think also like they had, it gave... because it's like a humorless movie. There's no jokes in it except like one where Harrison Ford says, if this works, you get to be Postmaster General. Yeah. And I was like, that's very funny. That's a good line.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's not a laugh throughout the entire
movie. No, especially compared to modern action movies. I have a tough time, I think, being straight faced, but this one is very straight. Harrison Ford gets a couple cracks, but not much. It is no John McClane.
No, but I think the smartest thing they do about it is that you are genuinely scared for the hostages. Like the hostages are like, okay, they're either going to shoot down the plane or they're just going to shoot them all one by one. And you see right away, like what's so great about this villain is that he makes it very clear right away. He is not messing around and he shoots someone in the first second. Whereas the next movie we're going to be talking about, that doesn't necessarily happen and the hostages sort of disappear, but you become attached to these hostages and they do such, it's one of the best opening sequences where they're introducing you to an ensemble cast as he walks through and, you know, like people are talking about the football game with him and you're seeing the staff and how much they like each other. And like, you're just getting this introduction. You're like, okay, they're people, this is their like work environment, they like this, and now they're all being executed. And so you immediately have that feeling of, oh no, but I like them, I don't want them to die horribly. So you it's a brilliant way to introduce these characters and up those stakes because you care.
And I mean, that's the probably the greatest scene in the movie is the like when Harrison Ford could give himself up to save the like nice press secretary and realizes it's like the greater good that he just lets her die. And yeah, you see him struggling with it and his kid watching somebody get executed. And it's like real bleak stuff, but good. Like it's again, I guess this is the Wolfgang Petersen feeling like he wants a realistic kind of drama.
Were all these type of movies, were they in the wake of Die Hard? Was Die Hard the first like lone
These
man taking on
These are all considered Die Hard scenario movies. Even though there was stuff like that beforehand, that's really considered the center point and the gold standard where everything sort of goes off from it.
Yeah, right. I also, there's like, I mean, since I guess this episode is really the plane movies too. There's like a lot of this, weirdly. This is kind of the peak, and it was climbing up. I mean, because like Die Harder is planes. Passenger 57, always bet on black with Wesley Snipes is kind of the same thing.
I remember that line. I love that line.
Yes. Again, a great one. And he's like he's like an air marshal that's accidentally on a flight and he ends up being kind of the one against everybody. And my favorite is Executive Decision, the like Kurt Russell, Steven Seagal one.
Oh my God. This is real, like a trip through memory lane.
Yeah.
This is so funny.
So the 90s had a real, which like I love pulling out explanations and God knows why the 90s. Because most of the plane hijackings I think are in the like 70s.
Yeah, but
weirdly,
that's also with the jump, right? Where we don't have really any of these sort of disaster movies or even really terrorist movies in that way in the 80s and the early 90s. We kind of have this big, like, they're not all vogue anymore, if you will. And suddenly they all start coming back. And then 9/11 happens and no one can make them anymore for another decade or two, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Then it's got to be Thanos.
It's just got to be Thanos. Absolutely. Yeah. But, like, do you think that filmmakers like the challenge of trying to make a movie like that big in scope on such a small, like, literal area?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's also like it's both a challenge, which I think people love, and I think it's a challenge for writers, because I think especially that's I think why Executive Decision has like a amazing screenplay, but I would also say Air Force One is pretty good, because you're trying to figure out how do you get stuff on and off a plane, like what is the negotiation, and you're trying to figure out a new way where, well, like what will happen with the plane, you know, are they going to shoot it down? I think that's like the big thing you see with both of these films is they have the ability to now CGI some fighter jets to maybe shoot down the airplane, which is like that probably couldn't exist
before. You look at those scenarios and they're often like people who have big, big resumes, some of their best work, like Sidney Lumet, have a look at both Dog Day Afternoon and 12 Angry Men. Both of those are very similar in that they take place at the same time. There's lots of arguing happening within it, but the stakes are so high that you have to keep everything moving forward because you're with those people the whole time in this like pressure cooker, right?
It's also a way to save money, I think, because you're really just building one crazy plane set. And often those plane sets, I think especially something like a passenger plane set, to be fair, obviously Air Force One and famously even Turbulence apparently built a very elaborate set, but I think a lot of plane sets just sit around and you can just get one, you know, you can rent a plane set.
Well, this one apparently was so realistic looking, it, like people were going by it at LAX and being like, oh, Air Force One, is it LAX? I wonder what the president's doing here. And that it almost got shot down out of airspace because apparently the people there were like really concerned it was like an unidentified airplane, but it looked like Air Force One and they thought it was some sort of incident. They managed to get that cleared up. But yeah, apparently it was real looking.
Wow. Can you imagine Harrison Ford dead because he was blown up in a plane?
Well, actually, that's going to happen. Yeah.
I was going to say, I can imagine Harrison Ford dying in a plane crash for sure. That guy loves to crash a plane. I mean, that's the other thing I love. With any, like, this guy seems like a real, like, grumbling Republican president. And it's like, all I know about Harrison Ford is he loves flying his plane and just smoking so much weed, which I'm trying to envision that with him on Charlie Rose being like, we need a less messianic president. Like, who is this guy? I just want to know more about that guy. What's his deal?
All right. Is it also weird to you guys that Gary Oldman turns in not one, but two of his greatest villain performances, of which it is a abundance of riches in 1997, because he also has The Fifth Element this same year.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, dang. Wow. And then when did The Professional or
that's
Lee?
That's earlier. 94, 95? Yeah. And I think that's what got him this, right? Because this is also a guy who loves to yell. This is a guy that loves
go
to
go quiet and
scream.
Then yell. 94.
Yes. Okay, yeah. Yeah, because I feel like there's a real through line between those two guys. Where this guy's, like you say, he's a bit more of a ideological guy. The professional guy's just nuts. But
that's right. Yeah. He has no structure to his. Yeah.
No. And also, I mean, we actually researched a bit on Fifth Element, and it's kind of fascinating when we talk about the 90s and this effects stuff. The Fifth Element had at the time the largest explosion ever captured on film.
Really?
Which is like, yeah, so they were also pushing the boundaries, as much as we're like CGI blah blah blah, they were really pushing the boundaries on what was physically happening on set as well. And I think probably it peaked then. You know, like, is anybody bothering to make that big an explosion
it's
anymore?
It's also probably too expensive, CGI. Especially in terms of insurance, because if it can be done with CGI, which in certain cases we are seeing it should just be done with CGI, I think that's the biggest thing is for insurance and safety purposes, people are pushing more and more towards that.
Yes. Yeah. Don't make bigger explosions. Don't listen to me on that regard. And also, we don't even know that. Like, I had to read that. I never would have noticed that the explosion in Fifth Element was the biggest ever.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, also, what year did Jurassic Park come out?
93.
So this was after Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I feel like always when there's a movie like Jurassic Park, which is like, okay, this is now the standard of what CGI is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
And then you see this several years later, and it feels like something as bad as what would become before Jurassic Park.
Yeah, there's a lot of rough stuff. The explosion behind him is real rough. The stuff that's on the ground at the airport is tough looking. Yeah, it's
when
weird.
It crashes into the ocean, it literally looks like a flight simulator video game.
This is also the same year as The Relic, which is one of the first horror movies I saw, so I have a very soft spot in my heart for it. But you look at the creature in The Relic, and it's, even now you see really bad CGI and stuff. It's just like, it depends on how it's used. It depends on how judiciously. Like, one of the reasons why Jurassic Park holds up so well is you can't see the CGI because it's so judiciously used.
Yeah, I believe there's, like, famously, the crazy thing is that there's only, like, 4 minutes of CGI in Jurassic Park. They wherever possible, avoided it. And they also, I think, it had post-production that went on forever, because it was Spielberg, and he was allowed to just be like, we're doing... Like, I think Spielberg was like, the star of this is the dinosaurs, they have to look immaculate. And that's why that movie, it doesn't even look like it's aged that much. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, but, it's the same with Independence Day, because they had... all models, so you're like, there are this does look like a thing blowing up as opposed to like something.
Oh, totally.
And Jeff Goldblum is ageless, right?
So, sure.
Where is he ever?
I also think it's worth saying, like, because there's actually three plane movies. Becky will be talking in another episode about Con Air, but I think especially Turbulence and Con Air compared to this one, it's a lot more practical. Like, Turbulence, I think, is mostly practical and models and things. Con Air, I also think. I think maybe Con Air, I think it's a lot of models. Because I think even going through the Hard Rock Cafe is a model.
It's the sands. It goes through the sands. And that's, it's not a model. Okay. It's the real sands. The sands was closing down. And so they crashed the actual plane into the Vegas building to be able to get that shot.
This is the stuff that they're missing nowadays.
That's
not
right.
Enough casinos shutting down for us to drive planes through.
We have a movie coming to Hollywood Suite called Shakedown, a James Glickenhouse movie. And I got to go to a Q&A with James Glickenhouse. And there's a part where Sam Elliott's fighting a guy on a roller coaster.
Nice.
And Sam Elliott just like shoots the tracks and the roller coaster goes off the tracks with the guy on it. And if somebody asks like, oh, hey, can you explain like the special effects process? And then he goes, we turned the tracks around and we shot a roller coaster. and the whole crowd like went wild because he was like, yeah, no, we just threw a roller coaster off the roller coaster. Why? We couldn't afford to do anything else. And we were like,
yeah, what was it? You got a better idea? How
Yeah. Why would we spend money when we can just fire a roller coaster off the roller coaster?
Oh, there's one thing that really stuck out to me is one of the henchman goons really gives up being a henchman where he has a gun pointed at his head. And he tells, like, when they're asking, is everything all right? And he says, yes. It's like, well, you turncoat, like, you, everybody else is putting their life on the line. And you're like, not me, man. I'm not going down for anybody.
He ultimately gets sucked out the plane, too. That's right. I like that. When his buddy blows up the door and ruins the pressure. Yeah.
This movie is absurd. I'm glad I watched it. I'm glad it is now in my like pantheon head of things that I have now seen thanks to this podcast.
Absolutely.
Had you never seen
it before?
I've never
seen it before. No, this was, spent, as you will hear in the Air Force One episode, the boy that I liked really liked Nicolas Cage. So I snuck into both.
Oh, Con Air.
Con Air and Face Off. Yeah. So I snuck into both those movies with the boy I liked, but not this one. So that's why I hadn't seen it yet.
Okay, fair enough.
Good choice.
I think so. I stand by it. I'm sure he has a great job in a bank somewhere, so that's good. That's how I wish people well. All right. When we come back, with Harrison Ford's performance being so little, we needed a performance that was off the scale enormous, and Ray Liotta is going to give us that in abundance. And also, Lauren Holly, just giving her for the team. That's coming up after the break.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's a twofold definition in the word disaster movie. Both, of course, a terrible tragedy occurring on a large scale on screen, and a total tanking of a movie that destroys the studio that created it. Turbulence hit the screen on 1997 and crashed the film division of Reicher Films. Was it that bad? Or should it have been saved on the strength of a frankly bonkers performance of Ray Liotta and the potential star power of the original on-screen Betty Cooper herself, Lauren Holly? Cam, Turbulence, and if we're going to be honest, the multiple inexplicable sequels. Let's go.
Oh, yeah. I mean, number one, we're probably going to have a lot of fun at Turbulence's expense, but I very much enjoyed watching it. I think it kind of rules in its own way. But yes, Turbulence also, like you say, total disaster, but managed to have a fairly successful direct-to-video franchise, including, number one, they're very Canadian films, full of Canadian actors, so I suggest people look them up. Number two, Turbulence Fear of Flying is about a group of people who are afraid of flying in a terrorist situation on a plane, which is delightful. Number three, Turbulence Heavy Metal is about a hacker taking over a plane during a heavy metal concert, and yes, the heavy metal musician has to fly the plane. Which is amazing. A guy named Slade, who is played by the lead singer of Spirit of the West. Canadian fans. Yes, yes.
Wow.
It is a crazy film that is worth... I'm glad Turbulence exists for heavy metal. Anyway, and both of those make Turbulence 1 look like Air Force, basically, because, they're
much... I also love that the sequels are like, you know what people love? The Turbulence.
That's what people are here for. Yes.
Yeah.
So yes. We can do that any which way. We don't need Lauren Holly back. We just need Turbulence. Yeah.
And also, it's interesting because both of the sequels have actors who I think have had comebacks, but at the time were like kind of laid low. Turbulence 3 has Joe Mantegna and like Gabrielle Anwar. And Turbulence 2 has Jennifer Beals as the it's kind of just like, okay, these guys are starring in a movie that stars the guy from Spirit of the West. Like, what are you talking about? Anyway, Turbulence. To quickly go through the plot, as you say, it's actually a very complicated plot in a way. It's kind of a few threads. Thread one is Hector Elizondo is a police officer who has sort of railroaded Ray Liotta, who is a guy who skipped bail. Hector Elizondo believes he is a serial killer and a rapist. Ray Liotta maintains his innocence, and the film doesn't really let you know for a while. He is being transported to Los Angeles to go stand trial. Simultaneously, Lauren Holly expects her boyfriend to ask her to get married, and he doesn't. So she is heartbroken.
He, in fact, dumps her without even saying it to her face. He sends the doorman.
He 90s-style ghosts on her completely by sending a doorman. So there she is kind of miserably working the Christmas shift on this plane, which is meant to be mostly empty. It's got, 10 passengers, and then it has Ray Liotta and strangely cast playing a Southern robber, Brendan Gleeson. And then through a series of events, the pilots are killed is basically the main problem. And then Lauren Holly is left not knowing who to trust, as Ray Liotta seems like he might be good, he might be bad. And she, but she seems like the person who has to fly the plane. We also have people on the ground, led by Rachel Tecoten as the, you know, as we said, the flight control deck.
Who is also in Con Air this year.
Yes, also in Con Air. She is the woman who is, who did two 1997 put upon, yes, she is the, she's the police officer on the plane.
She's the guard,
right?
Yeah, yeah, but, who solely exists for, to be harassed and menaced by Johnny 23, yes.
I think she kills, so she gets to kill him.
She
pretty
does,
cool,
that's
though,
correct,
she?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And then the, like, farthest plot is the guy from Chariots of Fire, Ben Cross, is another pilot that is helping Lauren Holly. And maybe sparks fly. Yeah, so that's about it. And slowly we are revealing, I mean, if you want to know it unspoiled, pause now and watch Turbulence. Ray Liotta is a maniac who essentially turns this into like a, almost like a horror movie. Like it becomes flying the plane and then also like a slasher movie where he's just menacing.
We talk about a lot of performances on the show as being unhinged, but I feel like this set a new bar for unhinged. For someone who not directed at any point, there is no conduction of this performance. Yes. There was just, we're going to aim you like a missile. Please just go and terrify Lauren Holly, which if I was acting opposite that, I'd be terrified as well. So
yeah, he really like, he Ray Liotta's all over the place.
Yes.
He's like, yeah, because it's a lot of the things that he's, that he does really well in Goodfellas, where he's like, come on, help me out. And then he goes nuts on somebody.
Yeah.
And so he was really fun to watch in this. It was really, really, like you say, unhinged is the word. Yeah.
Becky talked to me like halfway through the movie and she was like, I don't know, do you really want to do this? And then I went and watched it and I think I was like, Becky, you got to watch that back half of that movie.
That
Ray Liotta is going to do something that is going to change your mind on Turbulence.
And you know what? You did. You are correct. The back and forth. I was like, this is wild. And the fact that it turns into speed at the end of the movie, I was like, sorry, what?
Oh, yeah. Because it's weird that like the murderer serial killer rapist on the plane is literally like one of the least of her problems, because Ray Liotta's plan is to just crash the plane into Los Angeles, so she, like Air Force One, has like F-18s on her tail wanting to blow her up, and they don't trust her to properly land the plane. There's a whole thing where at one point they pseudo almost land and she accidentally gets a truck caught on one of the landing gears. That's like a whole plot.
And one of my favorite things in that is when that truck is flying through the air under her wheel, is somebody goes, it's a Ford.
Yeah, I mean, this is so like this, as you say, this movie is totally unlikely. I mean, I know that you wanted to talk a bit about Susan Seidelman's husband, Jonathan Brett, wrote this. But from what I can tell, he wrote a spec script that he sold for $1 million. And I am not sure how much of that survives, because it was rewritten by Stephen A. D'Souza, who wrote Die Hard. So it was rewritten by like the 48 Hours Commando Die Hard guy. That's why this one, I think, feels a little more like an 80s. Action movie, because it's bonkers. And it's also directed by Robert Butler, who is mostly a TV director, but he also directed all those old Kurt Russell movies for Disney, which is kind of weird.
Whoa.
He did like The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes and like The Barefoot Executive. So but he's a guy that had mostly been doing TV in the lead up to this. And as you said, like, I guess to also quickly get a lot of get my info dump out of the way, Reicher Entertainment that produced this is mostly a TV thing. I think, Graham, you will love how weird this company is. They started off as Bing Crosby Productions, number one.
Nice.
So they were producing like Hogan's Heroes and stuff. They went away for a while, and then they returned in 1991 specifically to distribute Saved by the Bell.
I knew that it had some kind of like, I remember the Reicher.
You
logo.
Remember it's the like the little skyline at the end of Saved by the Bell. But then they became pretty huge, because they were Saved by the Bell, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and Star Search. So it was all the like you know, the syndicated stuff of the early 90s. And that becomes so huge that they eventually team up with MGM for this movie deal. It does continue on as a TV thing for a while, and weirdly, it does Oz and Sex and the City, like the early kind of HBO hits.
Right.
But then it completely gets consumed in 2001. But yeah, this MGM deal, I think, as you were saying, Becky, was not great.
Yeah.
It gave us some movies that you might like Primal Fear, Kingpin, the silly comedy.
Private Parts, if you are a particular Howard Stern fan. Yes.
I think Private Parts is actually not a bad movie. It's what
if you're a Howard Stern fan, I get it. Yeah. There's a particular love there.
Yes. Kiss the Girls, I think, kind of rules the Morgan Freeman, Ashley Judd thriller, the first of those. And Don Roos is the opposite of sex is great, too. But yeah, they all their MGM ones, it's, let's see, the 2 Days in the Valley, which was kind of have a hit, kind of like a Tarantino riff. House Arrest, which I've never heard of, starring Jamie Lee Curtis and Kevin Pollak. Have you ever seen
that? Yes, I know that very well. I know House Arrest. I've definitely seen House Arrest.
Well, there you go, Graham, number one House Arrest fan. Turbulence, Zeus and Roxanne, which is the one where it's like a dolphin and a dog team up. It was like a kid's movie that I feel like nobody watched. With Steve Guttenberg. And that's it. Yeah. And then so the other reason why this existed at all is MGM wasn't producing anything at the time. They were in the middle of some sort of financial deal. So they kind of desperately turned to places. But it's just a kind of a wild business thing. We love these little business things. But it's weird. I don't know. It's weird that Turbulence took them down. I think it's just because Turbulence cost
it did.
So much,
and the other thing I think is really interesting is that this is their second time using Lauren Holly. And then they also paired her in a romantic comedy with Greg Kinnear, who they also used in another film. So it seems like they were kind of trying to build their empire around these two actors who are fine actors. I wouldn't just say that like they're that they're like household names. Like the biggest thing Lauren Holly had was Dumb and Dumber. She had just come off that movie, and she was married to Jim Carrey, and so that kind of made her a tabloid household name. Because you know what kind of weirdo would be married to Jim Carrey? But I think
somebody who likes to laugh.
Yeah,
she has a story. Right? I watched a clip of her on Watch What Happens Live. I've been going to Watch What Happens Live for research a lot recently, and I don't know why.
A lot of great dirt on that show. I don't know why. I think sassy women who tell it like it is.
That's right. Well, she was talking about how, like, apparently they got so bad with the tabloids that, like, they were going through their garbage to look for things. And so Andy Cohen asks, did you ever plant something? And she goes, I was married to Jim Carrey. Of course we planted stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know. Do you have, Graham, what do you think of Lauren Holly? Could she lead a movie? I don't know.
Like you say, I knew her primarily from Dumb and Dumber. Yeah. And I didn't. The funny thing is, I thought she was quite good in Turbulence because she really plays. She doesn't ever become somebody who's like, okay, now I know what I'm doing. Like she never, you know, she kind of figures out little things, but she doesn't become this. Because even in the movie, they're like, okay, automatic pilot, we'll land it. You've gotten us this far. We're not going to get you to land the plane because, so she never. She never gets that confidence back, in the movie. Like she's always second guessing everything. So I thought she was good. I thought she was very effective in the role. So I would say, you could build, the direct to video thriller certainly with her in the lead. I think.
I think she's playing the script, and the script isn't good. And I think that's the issue. And so a lot of people actually do pin this film's failure on her performance. They talk about how she's inappropriately cast. Really? She's not a good action hero. But Graham, I'm with you. I think she's playing the script as hard as she can, and it's just there's nothing there. She's not an active participant. She's just reacting to everything. And I think it's a take on, like, I really do think this comes down to Speed, is that he's using the Sandra Bullock character in Speed as the model who is much more active in that literal driver's seat than Lauren Holly is. And I think that's the problem with it.
Well, but in Speed, though, Sandra Bullock picks up things so fast that it's, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like Lauren Holly is more like what a person would actually be like.
True.
On a plane if something insane like this happened, like you're always looking for help somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so, and two times in the movie when Ray Liotta turns out to be the psycho killer and is trying to kill her. And then also when she realizes that the government is getting ready to blow her plane out of the air, she kind of reacts the way that you would, like, I trusted somebody and now it's been taken from under me, you know?
Yeah, it's true. I do think it's interesting. And she, like, there are some, I think that there's some kind of eye roll turns. Obviously, there's like, they try to build a weird, maybe sexual tension between her and Ray Liotta, which is stupid.
That's right.
Because he's also, like, the weird thing is he's always unsettling. Like, he always seems weird, even if you don't at first know if he's a murderer.
Ray Liotta. Like, there's a reason Karina did not work.
Like, I was completely... I mean, yeah, this is a whole other thing to say, is, like, this is the mid, like, post-Goodfellas, where they're trying to make Ray Liotta a leading man. And I think both him and Lauren Holly kind of have the thing where it's, like, they're very good-looking character actors, I think. You know? They're more... And he gets the role that's a little more character-y. And she is, unfortunately, stuck in the, like, thing where she has to eventually, like, nut up and shoot him because she's, like, too nice to begin with and can't shoot him.
And also, he's supposed to be this, like, so smooth-talking that he's talked all these women into and then he kills them. And he's still playing that note, like it's gonna, like he's like, oh, what's your favorite book? What's your favorite?
And he's just so
yes, that's true. After he's like clearly, she thinks pretty clearly he's murdered everyone. Then he's still trying to flirt with her, and it's so weird.
Where is everybody?
You know, I was kind of wondering that myself. Oh, they just disappeared. It's kind of creepy, isn't it? So let me ask you something. What's your favorite movie?
What's my favorite movie?
Yeah, what? Look, don't answer a question with a question, all right? Only stupid people do that, and you're obviously a very bright woman. Now, what's your favorite movie?
But I even mean, like, when he gets on the plane, I had not seen this movie before, and I was confused at first because I was like, oh, is she in on this, like, terrorist takeover? Because he just kept asking her such weird stuff when he's like... Like, what's the movie on the plane? He's like, oh, It's a Wonderful Life. What's that song they sing in it? And you're like, oh, this is obviously some sort of code. But it's just him being so
weird.
It
is just to allow him to sing Buffalo Girls at the top of his lungs as he creates mayhem. That's the best scene. It's so good.
Menacingly play It's a Wonderful Life in the back. We should say, like, I don't know. I guess I kind of touched on it, but this is like, cue this up for your alternate Christmas festival, because this is very Christmas.
But is that because this is the Die Hard guy and he's like, worked once with Die Hard, let's do it again with Turbulence.
I mean there is this weird thing, and I want your guys' opinion on it, but there are multiple acts, because Shane Black sets almost all his movies at Christmas. Almost every Lethal Weapon is a Christmas movie, so it's like, yeah, what is it about action movies and Christmas, guys? What does it
stakes
mean?
And it's just like a weird place to set a movie. Like, the thing that I don't know if you guys, if it bothered you a lot, but like the decorations on the inside of the plane.
Yeah.
Like, Roger Ebert said the same thing, is like, has that ever happened on any plane in the world?
Well, I mean, I like the little exchange at the start where she's like, oh, they really did it up. And then the male steward you barely see is like, there was a contest and we lost. And you're like, oh, a wonderful little script note. But you're right. It's so weird. There's a lot of moments you just can't think about it. My friend would say, I had drinks with my friend Trevor last night, and he was like, you know, that, like, the whole plane flips over, which is a wild thing. But he's like, you know that everybody, pretty much everyone alive on that plane is crammed into a little room. And he's like, and it flips over? Those people are dead, right? He's like, those people all landed on their heads.
But that's
right?
The other thing that's fascinating to me about this, and you can't say it's a budgetary thing, because this is a $25 million movie. Like, this is not
and
a
it looks
cheap
great.
Movie.
It looks like a professional big action movie. And like we were saying, in some ways it looks better than Air Force
but
One.
But the hostages disappear. Like, they just put them in a little room, and then you don't hear from them. I forgot they were there. I was like, did he throw them out the
same
back?
Here.
Was there like a hatch?
The one thing I give it, that I think when they're playing that kind of horror vibe in the last act, is that I think they want you to think all those people are dead.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's like a weird moment where she's walking through the cabin looking for her flight attendant friend.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a skateboard sitting on one of the seats, and she stares at the skateboard, and you're like, oh, she's going to end up using the skateboard.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a Chekhov skateboard.
To Ray Liotta.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean,
never happens.
I definitely want to talk about that. They set up, like, the opening of this movie is a pretty typical action kind of thriller opening. And they set up a lot of the stuff that you would expect. Like, and it drives me nuts in a movie where they're like, they show somebody with their, like, you know, kit of diabetes medicine. And you're like, oh, boy, somebody's going to go into diabetic shock. Maybe they're going to stab somebody with a bunch of needles. Like, I love that stuff in my head. And this one is crazy because, yes, he has the skateboard. They have the kid come on the thing with a skateboard. They have the old lady kind of being like, she's a little frail, and you're like, oh, what's gonna happen with this old lady? And nothing happens.
The husband's like, let me sit on the outside. I gotta sit on the outside.
Yes, there's all this
okay, that's business gonna come about back.
Yeah, what people are gonna eat and drink, and you're like, oh, well, he's gonna have a steak knife because he got steak, and it's like, no.
But why did they make Brendan Gleeson Southern? There is no reason for that man to be Southern.
What would you like?
Locked and nail you, baby.
There's two strike stubs. One more and I will gag you.
You got a short fuse, Marshall. It's gonna be a long flight.
The whole Brendan Gleeson of it all. Like, Brendan Gleeson is the guy that hijacks the plane, seemingly not in coordination with Ray Liotta. Ray Liotta is just taking advantage of the situation, and Ray Liotta kills Brendan Gleeson almost immediately, which is great for the, like, is he good, is he bad? But again, it's like, the weird thing is, most of these movies, like you said before, is like about a terrorist, kind of a very distinct plan. Like Air Force One is a very elaborate plan that seemingly could never happen, whereas this is essentially Ray Liotta taking advantage of a series of weird circumstances. He didn't want the pilots to die. The one guy just gets knocked, his neck breaks or something. This is all random.
But I'm also going to point people towards the most implausible thing of the idea of an empty plane at Christmas time, so they have to transport prisoners.
Oh, and I mean, this is also one of those snakes on a plane planes that's like three levels tall, and this is like the biggest possible 1997 plane.
Yeah, and it's the same. Yeah. Air Force One was like two stories, so at least you can have the characters not just up and down the same aisle over and over again.
Yes, true. And this one, I mean, the part of the reason it cost so much is because they had a set that could actually spin around. So
did they really?
Yeah, they built a giant gimbaled set so they could turn it upside down.
VFX people love this movie. They love models. They love this whole thing. This was a whole. So if you go on YouTube, there are so many making of documentaries about this because people are fascinated with the special effect practical element of it.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, and it looks good. I can't deny. It's just all the crazy stuff happening inside the plane.
I love watching these interviews, though, because sometimes you get the minutiae that drive VFX people nuts that, like, you wouldn't think of as a filmmaker or as a viewer, where they were like, they painted the plane white and they want it against clouds. Well, guess what? You're not going to be able to see. And, like, and just getting so upset about little things. It's so funny.
They should have Christmas wrapped the plane. I guess they didn't do that.
A big
back
red
then.
Bow as it goes through the sky.
Yeah.
Then they would have won that competition.
Yeah, there you go. That's maybe what won, though. Yeah, I love, like, as much of the silly stuff as silly, I also kind of enjoy, like, I just think getting the truck stuck on the wheel is a great little gimmick. And then having the F-18 shoot the truck off instead of shooting her down is, like, a very charming moment.
I love charming is used so liberally in this conversation.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing, I just love it. And I love, crazy Ray Liotta just trying his best to crash that plane no matter what. He's just shooting up computers that he doesn't know how they work. It's so weird.
He also, like, I just found the people on the ground would chance a plane flying into downtown Los Angeles to save one person.
So there are all of these, like, angry debates on the internet when you go down, like, reviews of this, like, on Letterboxd, and people are like, this wouldn't happen. She is very irresponsible for not letting them shoot her down in the middle of the ocean. And it's like, she's not Harrison Ford. I'm sorry.
Also, really is there? Do they ever deal with whether there's parachutes or not? Because that never even really comes up in this one.
I don't think there are parachutes on commercial planes. It's the same as with Air Force One doesn't have parachutes either, because apparently if you're that high up, it's not safe, and you're untrained. It's not safe to jump. So,
as we learned in excruciating detail in Air Force One, of how low and slow a plane needs to fly.
The weird thing is, too, in Air Force One, just going back to the one scene when it has, you know, when they're saying, lower the plane to 15,000 feet. There's a whole thing about a fax, and they see the fax coming. You see it coming in, and nobody picks it up. And then suddenly, somehow, somebody's picked it up. Is there a scene where they actually pick up?
It's a real IMDb goofs. I don't remember that scene. I agree with you. I thought I looked away maybe and missed it, but if you also didn't notice it.
Yeah, I didn't notice
it. It's in the director's cut, guys, when it gets even more into the minutiae.
I mean, yeah, I'm glad Lauren Holly isn't sending faxes, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah, anyway, this movie is just bonkers, and I think it's pretty delightful, and I love also that Hector Elizondo is a crooked cop who is ultimately right. lied and he planted evidence, but he's right.
And I think that's why there's such an interesting movie inside this movie. Like, I can see why they paid for the treatment what they paid for it. Well, not that much money, maybe not $1 million. But, like, the concept itself is kind of interesting. And especially, like, you see where the twists are supposed to be. And by the time, and I don't want to, I'm not doing my best not to be ageist here. Older people can make excellent movies as well. But by the time the director got a hold of this, he was over 70 years old and mostly had television in his career. And I don't know if he knew how to handle the twists. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and they built like we said, they built in a lot of stuff and then only a couple of things actually paid off. But you could see that's kind of like a mistake of a director is set up all these things and then none of them happen. And then you forget that there's even people there. And then also the thing that I couldn't get my head around is I'm sure they transport prisoners by air, but they don't put them on the same flight.
No, they're never on commercial flights. That is not a thing that happens.
imagine how horrible you would feel that you've booked this plane trip and then you're like, oh, what? We're on the prisoner plane trip? Like, I should get a discount at the very least.
I think they'll do a prison to prison transport, but not often a guy who's set to do trial.
Yeah, that's what Con Air was for, right? That's the entire point of Con Air.
But does Con Air exist?
Yeah, no, Con Air is a real special prison plan? Real thing. Yes, that is great.
Is it really?
Literally, we just
spoilers for the future episode, sorry.
Actually, it just happened, so it's not. So yes. Oh, okay. So yeah, the Con Air is a real thing. That's part of this.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. I think we need to end that here with the revelation that Con Air is a real plane. I mean,
Con Air is real. Turbulence, you probably couldn't survive.
Santa,
Air Force One.
Maybe.
The pod is up for debate.
Yes. It's so funny to me that there's so many things that came out after Air Force One of this isn't real. This isn't real. It could never work this way. Please don't try this, terrorists. And the big thing, of course, is whether or not the escape pod is a real thing, because they say it doesn't exist, but there's a wink, wink of no, it totally exists.
Yeah.
So,
and can I say that the one thing that Turbulence nailed that Die Hard had is stripping down to that white shirt and having it just filthified by the end.
She also gets a cool cut on her face, and I'm I don't remember where she got
but she looks
cut.
Great.
But it looks good. It looks badass. And she gets a very good, she gets lots of good kiss-off lines. She gets a lot more wisecracks.
Yeah.
She gets to shoot him butt good at the end. It's it's good.
That's right.
And possibly fall in love.
Yes, true. She does get to fall in love.
All right. Cameron Maitland, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you. And once again, Turbulence 3 Heavy Metal added to your
the
watch
trailer
list
alone.
Now.
I sent the trailer to Graham for him to have a look. It is something. So I think the thing that is most fascinating that people are really excited about is that when the heavy metal guy gains control of the plane, he then prays for their salvation. And a lot of people are really excited about seeing a heavy metal guy who is also a hardy Christian. So that's good.
Nice. I mean, it's also Satanists. Yeah. The hackers are Satanists. It's a whole thing.
And Graham, thank you so much for joining us once again for this very weird trip out.
Oh, thank you so much. I had never heard of Turbulence, so it was neat to be able to see it because it was so much fun to watch.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad we hit the Graham.
Because I was also like, abort. I'm glad we didn't. I'm glad we stuck with it. Graham, how can people hear you and your fun voice?
You can listen to my podcast called Stop Podcasting Yourself. You can find it on all the places you usually find podcasts. And I'm on Twitter. I'm at Graham Clark. And on Instagram, I'm at Graham Clark Was Taken.
Nice.
I like it very much. And you can join us next week where we're going to be having a Business Ladies special. We're also going to be joined by the fantastic Carolyn Morissette to look at Romy and Michelle's high school reunion and BAPS. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen, on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Cameron Maitland and Graham Clark as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.